1768, writing in his journal that John Wesley commented that many people were now treating the subject of the occult and witchcraft far too lightly, and very few any longer took these matters seriously. 32 years earlier, in 1736, Parliament had abolished the death penalty for persons accused of witchcraft. Until then, execution had been practiced as the punishment for witches. But when one hears of the supposed witches who were executed, one's blood runs cold. For example, in Dornoch in the north of Scotland, an old woman had been put to death in 1722 for alleged witchcraft. Her daughter had had sore hands and sore feet. And the charges brought were that the old woman had turned her daughter into a donkey, had had her shod by the devil himself, and then had ridden her through the night. Hence the sore feet and the sore hands. And people actually believed that charge, and the court sentenced her to death, and the sentence was carried out. Little wonder then that many were beginning to regard stories of witchcraft as old wives' tales, and little wonder that Parliament had abolished the death penalty. And yet, while the pendulum swung too far from belief in the power of the occult, it needed a John Wesley and a George Whitefield to call a halt and to urge Christian people not to be quite so dogmatic that the devil had been an illusion after all and could now be safely forgotten. I think in our day that we're realizing that, aren't we? The jokes and the tall stories about the devil have given way to horrendous accounts of Satanism, and we're dimly aware of dark powers seething just below the surface of society. Well, the story that we're following in 1 Samuel begins with just such dark and mysterious powers, the practice of them, and certainly belief in them. It's a story, however, in which the power of God shines forth with radiance and glory. It's all about power, and our first point is the power of God over evil. Have you ever met someone who tells you, "I don't believe in God anymore. There was a time when I did, but I prayed to him and he didn't answer me. When I needed him, he wasn't there, so don't ask me to believe in him anymore. There was no God there when I called on him." Have you ever heard that? I tell you, I have. Many, many times. That was the kind of objection to belief in God and in the power of prayer that we might well have come across in the land of Israel in the early days of Samuel. Hadn't the people been forced to fight the Philistines? Hadn't they prayed that God would help them? Hadn't they even sent and brought the Ark of the Covenant and carried it into battle against their enemies? That God had been silent. Worse still, God had been beaten, overcome by the power of the Philistines' god Dagon, and so the faith of many a man and many a woman in those days had been very badly shaken. They had prayed, but God had neither answered nor helped. Worse still, the ark, symbol of his presence and glory, had been captured and desecrated. Now the interesting thing is that the Philistines still believed in the God of Israel, and so they took the ark, this symbol of the presence and glory of God, and they placed it in one of their god Dagon's temples. It was the temple at Ashdod, and Ashdod was their main seaport, and that's important. But we can be sure that they placed it in a position of subservience to their god Dagon, for Dagon had given them the victory. Dagon was the greatest. The God of Israel must acknowledge the greatness and the superiority of Dagon. Archaeologists actually are able to tell us quite a bit about this god Dagon. It used to be believed that he was a fish god, but there's no evidence for that. That comes from a comment of Jerome away back in the 4th century. Dagon is mentioned many times in the Old Testament. He was held to have been the father of the god Baal. When Joshua apportioned the promised land to the 12 tribes, the record tells us that there was a temple to Dagon in the territory that was given to Judah, and there was another one in the territory that was given to Asher. Samson, you remember, had died in a temple of Dagon whilst a prisoner of the Philistines, Saul's head and his armor, when he died, were placed by the Philistines in the temple of Dagon at a place called Beth-shan. The first known mention of this pagan god occurs in Mesopotamia, where Abram lived before he migrated to Palestine, and that first mention is dated much, much earlier than Abram, about 250 BC. A temple of Dagon has been excavated at a place called Mari in Syria, and also one has been found at Ugarit in Phoenicia. The Egyptian pharaoh Ramesses II, he records a temple of Dagon in Palestine in 1270, the time of Joshua. And Sennacherib, you remember Sennacherib, the Assyrian, he mentions a temple of Dagon in 701 BC. So Dagon was a popular god. Some thought he was the god of corn, others the god of the clouds and the rain. In other words, he was a fertility god who was supposed to bring good crops. And so amid great rejoicing, the symbol of the God of Israel was placed in Dagon's temple in Ashdod, beside the elevated statue of this ancient pagan god. But in the morning, Dagon's image was prostrate before the Ark of God. Now, that could have been coincidence. It might have been that Dagon's plinth was slightly wobbly, or it might have been that someone had knocked it while putting the Ark of God into place. So Dagon was carefully placed on his plinth again. But next morning, first thing early at the first light of dawn, and you need your authorized version to note that detail, it's glossed over in the NIV, the priests of Dagon hurried out to see how their god had fared the second night. But this time, not only was Dagon down, he was decapitated and his hands cut off. Now, apparently, pagan gods were sometimes represented as having the heads and the hands of their victims dangling at their waist. Rather gory little detail. But Dagon's hands and head are on the threshold of the temple entrance, a symbolic gesture that meant he was pleading for mercy. And then a plague broke out. Probably from the details given about the rats, it was a bubonic plague. We should just notice in passing that the Old Testament actually has a different attitude to signs and wonders and miracles to our modern attitude. We tend to think of miracles and wonders either as a suspension of the laws of nature or as actions which transcend the laws of nature or even reverse the laws of nature. But the Hebrew mind thinks of miracles as God's sovereign use of the natural order. And we'll come across this very powerfully in the mornings, going through Exodus. And so it is here. The writer of 1 Samuel understands that this plague has been sent by God. And the rats are mentioned explicitly. They will have invaded Ashdod, coming into the port through merchant ships. And with them they brought this dreaded disease which affected the glands in the groin and under the arm. But it was no accident that the arrival of the rats and the plague they brought coincided with the arrival of the Ark of the God of Israel. The God of Israel had brought the plague. No one could deny it. Witness the fall of Dagon before the power of the Ark, and Dagon's hands on the threshold pleading for mercy, his head broken off from his body. Strange and eerie occult events, enough to set tongues wagging and pulses racing. News is bound to have filtered through to Israel, and we could imaginarily settle ourselves down to listen to a conversation of an evening round the fire in Israel. One man is saying the God of Israel has let them down. The gods of the Philistines are more powerful. Someone else is throwing doubt on the great stories of the deliverance from Egypt 3 generations earlier. And a timid voice slips in a comment, "But I've heard that our God is bringing trouble on the Philistines. Wherever they take the Ark of God, they have disease and illness. They're even more afraid of our God than before they beat us in battle." And another chips in, "I've heard that too." And so an argument starts, and the word goes round, and rumor mixed with vague reports, facts mixed with fiction, are discussed night after night round the village fires. Now there are 2 points we should note here. And the first is, of course, that Dagon is long since dead and forgotten. All we know about him, helpful as it is, has been excavated from desert sands. But God isn't dead. He's still worshipped and adored across the world. And yet while Dagon is dead, the father of Dagon isn't dead. Satan himself is still at work. He's changed his disguise, but he's still hard at it, working on the hearts and minds of men and women. And John Wesley was quite right. The dark powers are still there, though with a different face. And the second point is this, that even when God's people fail him, God's not dead. He's the Eternal One, the Almighty, the Creator. Now, I'm going to tread as a fool where angels wouldn't tread, and I do so delicately and hope that the ice won't break and the cold water close over my head. But I know there's a solid core of majority opinion in Northern Ireland that is convinced that God's will for Ulster is that we stay as part of the United Kingdom. But just say a kind of creeping, insidious movement towards unification silently slips forward under our very noses. Perhaps through industrial and economic cooperation, but without our noticing it, until only an empty shell of union with Westminster remains, and the real truth is that for all practical purposes, the unthinkable has happened and Ireland is all but united. Would we still believe in God? That he had planned and willed it? That his timetable was being fulfilled? While here in the north a remnant of God's people are weeping and wailing and meeting clandestinely to consider what could be done, having prayer meetings for deliverance from the despised and unwanted and Catholic South. Oh, I know, it's only speculation, I know. Many would say such a thing could never, shall never happen. But you know, when I read my Bible and a story like this and I try and put flesh and blood on it, I wouldn't be so sure. I see Israel defeated, the unthinkable having happened, in shame, their enemies in the ascendancy, but through it all I see Israel's God glorious, laughing at his foes, having them in derision. And I do think that it might be wiser and better to be less dogmatic about what God might or might not do. God's power over evil is performed in mysterious ways. Let those hear who have ears to hear. Then secondly, and much more briefly, God's power over nature. We Christians can sometimes get ourselves into an awful twist over guidance. We set our course for the destination we want, and then we ask God to tell us that we're sailing on the right course, or else we demand all sorts of peculiar and way out signs from God to confirm our way of thinking. Now I have to say, I have been as guilty as anyone of this sort of thing. I remember while I was still in my first congregation in Aberdeen, over a 15-month period, I had about 15 approaches from vacant congregations, and I spent hours sweating over one after another, wondering, is this the one from God? Is it this one? Is it time I should be moving? And at last, after wasting literally days of traveling hundreds of miles for interviews in this place and that place, from the north to the south and east and west, and spending a lot of money on petrol and the expenses that you would incur when you're away from home for a day or two, I decided before God that I would say no, emphatically no, to any and every approach, and don't laugh, unless they offered me my expenses. Now, I hadn't been offered expenses by any of the approaches until then. I didn't tell anyone that. I didn't even tell my wife. But I just felt that it was wrong to be spending good money every month doing a couple of hundred of miles and all of no avail. So when the next approach came, I said I wasn't interested. And twice John Gilbert phoned back, and twice I said again, sorry, I'm not interested. But I promised to pray about it. And I prayed. And I prayed, Lord, if you want me to go and meet these people at Larvet, you'd better arrange for them to offer me expenses this time, unlike the last dozen times or more. Either that or send me the money to go the 250 miles there and back for an interview. Now, you might think that was an odd request, but supporting a family on the minimum stipend and trying to heat a 13-roomed country manse was taxing our income beyond its limits, and our children were dressed with clothes out of jumble sales. And then came the fourth and final telephone call from the ever-persistent Mr. Gilbert, and this time he began with the words, Now, if you're willing to come for an interview, we'll cover your expenses. And that was the first time out of 15 approaches. Now, we play these games with God, don't we? How can we be sure, God? Give me a sign. Is this right? Show me. And we put out the proverbial fleece that Gideon put out. Asking for such a sign goes back a long, long way. And we find the Philistine lords doing exactly that. Two cows recently calved that have never been harnessed to a cart are to be yoked together and hitched up containing the ark, along with the gold and gilt offering, 5 gold rats and 5 gold models of boils. Horrible gilt offering, but we have to understand why. Their calves are to be penned up, and if the cows pull the cart northeast towards Beth Shemesh, Israelite territory, then the God of Israel is driving the cows away from their young, and he it must be who's been causing the plague. And so it happened. God gave them the sign for which they asked. But you know, I want to see another meaning here for you and me. One we have elsewhere in the Old Testament, and it's this, that 2 cows were more obedient to God than the people of God themselves had been. 2 cows went straight along the road, neither turning to the right nor to the left, until they reached the first Israelite village. Can you remember when that happened before? Balaam's donkey had been the same. It had recognized the angel of God when Balaam himself had been totally blind to it. Isaiah opens his prophecy with these words, The ox knows her master, and the donkey his owner's manger, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand. And what we have here is not so much the sign, the wonder that a pagan people needed in order to know God's will, but we have the obedience of brute beasts to their maker and disobedience from his own people to their Lord. And the contrast is intended. The waves and the winds obeyed Christ, but his own people hated him, rejected him, preferred a robber and murderer to him, and crucified him. Has God said? Yes, God has said. We have his word, we have his holy commandments. They couldn't be clearer. They're here in our Bibles in black and white. And remember, the Ark of the Covenant was the container of the 10 commandments. It stood for the majestic holiness of God, and it stood for that holiness and the obedience that God demands from each one of us. And yet the truth is that a cow or a donkey or an ox can be trained more easily to obey its master than you or I can be trained to obey our loving Lord and Savior. No wonder God had to allow such a crushing and humiliating defeat on his people. No wonder. God's power over nature. Does your nature need taming and bringing under control? Does your nature threaten sometimes to break out and run in the very opposite direction to do that which God commands we shouldn't do? Oh, our wills are so unwilling. They rear and they buck like wild horses. Our wills do not want to obey the will of God. The great Augustine compares our human wills to a horse waiting its rider's command, and he compares the rider to either God or to the devil. He writes, and I quote, "If God sits astride my will, then as a moderate and skilled rider, he guides it properly, spurs it if it's too slow, checks it if it's too swift, restrains it if it's too rough or too wild, subdues it if it balks, and leads it into the right path. But if the devil saddles a man's will, he violently drives it far from the trail like a foolish and wanton rider, forces it into ditches, tumbles it over cliffs, and goads it into obstinacy and fierceness." That was Israel's problem. We saw it several weeks ago when we were last in 1 Samuel chapter 4. Have we forgotten already? We need to remember, don't we? Because it's still our problem. We need a God who has power over our natures. And we only welcome that power in our lives when we give him full obedience and hand our wills over to him. But when we seize the reins ourselves and determine to go our own way, then we're driven on by darker powers to destroy ourselves and our happiness. And I tell you, there are people in this building this evening, and you know perfectly well what I'm talking about. Go your own way, thrust God to one side and his commandments, disobey him, and even though you think you're heading for happiness, you'll find the devil will tumble you over the cliffs into a fierceness and obstinacy which deserves and brings down the wrath of God upon you. Then let us all pray every day, "Lord, take my nature, so wild and so restless, take it and subdue it. Control my will and make it meek and gentle and obedient to your will." Only God can make our unwilling wills willing for his perfect way. And that is his true power over nature. And then thirdly and finally, the power of God among his people. There's quite a revolution going on in church worship and singing just now. Perhaps as great a change is taking place in this decade and the past as there has been for many centuries in the kind of hymns that we sing, and that's all right. That's fine, we have to move with the times. But there is a danger that I think churches seem to sometimes ignore, and it's that in some of the new singing and tunes we become over-familiar with God. We think that because the world uses beat and rhythm and vastly increased decibels, that we should do the same. And apparently, without some people realizing what they're doing, the church begins to take on the world's standards in its worship. I heard only this past week from an absolutely impeccable source of one Christian leader who was unable to withstand the demands of the group of unconverted young people in her church for a disco, and so laid on a disco to please them, but got them discoing to Christian music instead of the usual disco music. And she apparently thought that discoing to Christian music would somehow sanctify what was going on. What goes wrong in so much of these modern trends? We become over-familiar with holy things, and we treat God as if he were a kind of chum, jovial, and we forget that he's the holy God, awesome in majesty and radiant in glory and awesome in power. There's another way of treating God wrongly, and it lies at the very opposite end of the spectrum to discoing to what is euphemistically called Christian music. It's the over-familiarity which Christians and maybe theological students in particular can develop as they look into the things of God. Sometimes we investigate and pry and peer into matters which are beyond our knowing with an arrogance and an impertinence and an intellectual cheek which creeps into our debates and discussions, which also is an over-familiarity with God and his things. Well, this happened when the Ark of the Covenant was brought back. While some rejoiced, others became over-familiar and they pried. They wanted to see what was in this golden box and what was beneath that golden lid with its four cherubim and their overarching wings. And they ended up contracting the same disease as had struck the Philistines, and some of them died because they had become too matey, too familiar, too easy with the things of God. Because true godliness always reverences God and recognizes that He is holy. True godliness always approaches Him with reverence and awe. True godliness is never slap-happy, never jokey, never careless about spiritual things. You've all heard, haven't you, of the Covenanters, those worthy Presbyterians who died violent deaths rather than give up. The principles they so firmly held were grounded in the Word of God. A contemporary of Robert Blair, about whom John Lockington is to lecture in First Bangor on Thursday evening, was a man called James Guthrie. Before his arrest and 8 months imprisonment and then his trial and execution in the Grassmarket in Edinburgh, Guthrie had been minister in Stirling, and he recorded that as he did his pastoral work and visited the poorer parts of his parish, he found, and I quote, "fever, famine, want, squalid nakedness, moral and physical impurity, drunkenness, death, and the very devil reigning." And then amidst all this, he came upon a simple home that was different. And he was astonished. The walls were freshly whitewashed inside and out. The simple furniture shone like a looking glass. A bright fire danced on the hearth. And he commented this home was an oasis in the desert. And whom did James Guthrie find living in that home? He tells us. The single room was occupied by a blind man who lived alone, but a man who feared and worshipped the Lord in spirit and in truth. He feared God and worshipped the Lord, the living God held in awe and enthroned in a poor man's heart. Revival is about to come to Israel, but before it could come, the lesson of the holiness of God had to be learned. The same God who brought Dagon's image crashing down, this God is our God, to be worshipped in spirit and in truth. Oh, how I fear you, living God, with deepest, tenderest fears, and worship you with trembling hope and penitential tears, but I may love you too, O Lord, though you are all divine. For you have stooped to ask of me this feeble love.